So Leitchik was very fond of stating that until until his grandfather came and analyzed the Yerideya, people used to treat Yerideya like a bunch of pots and pans. His grandfather, Rav Chaim, conceptualized the Yerideya and he made more sense out of things. That's what he printed in his sort of his hesped that he wrote about his father, Moshe Soloveitchik, and Isha Halacha. That's what he used to say orally on more than one occasion. Rabbi Soloveitchik's opinions on Yerideya were very serious ones, and we use them all the time when we work on issues of kashrus, but most of them I won't be able to say over tonight, because they're really conceptualizing a lot of halachas that are really intricate, very complicated, and maybe at the end of this series, when I'll give over some shiurim about Soloveitchik, just to show how he would analyze halachas, maybe I'll give a shiur on Yerideya. But tonight we'll just discuss some topics, halacha l'maaseh, some issues that come up halacha l'maaseh. I remember when we were studying Yerideya, so we were learning about basa b'chala. So the din is that meat and milk may not be cooked together. Not only are you not permitted to eat the meat that was cooked with the milk, you're not permitted to cook the basa b'chala, even if it's for non-Jewish consumption. And it's also asa b'hanoch. The Gemara learns that from Sukkim that it's asa b'dishul, you're not allowed to cook it, it's asa b'achivi, you're not allowed to eat it, and it's asa b'hanoch. If by mistake you cook meat and milk, you're not allowed to give it to the goyish next door neighbor, you're not allowed to feed it to the dog because you're not allowed to get any benefit from it. So Rabbi Soloveitchik used to tell over every other year, every third year, he would learn Yerideya with the students. I heard Yerideya, I think, four times from them. And it was more interesting the second time than it was the first time. It was more interesting the third time than it was the second time. Every time he would add on more, maybe he would, maybe just we would understand more. We would understand it better. He had a lot to say on Yerideya. So every time he learned Yerideya, he would be fond of telling over the story that a religious Jew was once drafted into the army and his job was to be the chef in the kitchen. So his shaila was that they gave him instructions. He has to cook basa b'chala for the non-Jewish soldiers. So what does he do? He's not allowed to. So Rabbi Soloveitchik asked him, what exactly is the basa b'chala? How bad is it? So he said that they asked him to do chicken with butter. So he said that we pass on that's mutter. Shulchan Aruch asked the question because chicken with milk is only the rabbanon. If you cook meat with milk, that's the biblical prohibition of basa b'chala. But the Tanaim have a dispute whether cooking chicken with milk is the biblical prohibition. It's only rabbinical. So we pass on it's only the rabbanon. So in the Shulchan Aruch we pass on halacha l'maaseh that since it's only basa b'chala the rabbanon, they only prohibited it to achila. You're not permitted to eat it. It's mutter l'bashlo. And it's muta bahana as well. If by mistake you cook some chicken and milk, so you don't have to throw it out. You can give it to the goyish neighbor, you can feed it to the dogs. So he said, halacha l'maaseh, that's how we passed it. There are those that disagree in Shulchan Aruch, but that's the psak that we accept. I remember one year we were learning Yerideya, so it says in the Shulchan Aruch that we have a minig that's mentioned in the Gemara, a very old minig, not to have milk after meat, even though you finished eating. You wait from one suda to the other. One of the Chachamim in the Gemara says that he can't compare to his father in religious observance. His father was so medactic, his father was such a machmir, he would wait 24 hours. If he had fleshiks, he would wait 24 hours till he would have milchiks. And the son says that I'm not so religious like my father, I only wait from one meal to the other. How long is that from one meal to the other? So the Rambam writes, kimo sheish shots, approximately 6 hours. Kimo she doesn't say 6 hours, he says approximately 6 hours. So some people have a practice, they wait 5.5 hours. Some people are actually 5 hours and 5 minutes, a little bit into the sixth hour. So somebody asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, what does he say about this into the sixth hour? He said, never heard. In some swam they quote that that was the practice of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, that he only waited into the sixth hour. So I don't know, Rabbi Soloveitchik said he never heard, but he doesn't know. So someone said, well, they started to argue, there is a din in Avelis, Rahman al-Islam, someone is sitting Shiva, so there's a din of Mikta Sayyar Kula. If you begin the seventh day, the beginning of the seventh day is enough. Or Shloshim, when it comes to Shloshim, the beginning of the 30th day is enough. You don't have to observe the whole day. So one of the boys suggested, he heard that it's the same thing over here. You really have to wait 6 hours, but you wait into the beginning of the sixth hour, that's enough. So Rav Soloveitchik screamed out and he said, that's utterly ridiculous. There is no such thing. The din of Mikta Sayyam Kukubai, if you observe the beginning of the day, that's the beginning of the last day of the unit. It's not a unit of calendaric days. It's something superimposed on the calendar. On Shabbos, you don't say Mikzei Yom Kukula. You don't say if you observe the beginning of Shabbos, the beginning of Yom Tov, or the beginning of Tisha B'Av, so that's enough, and you can eat the rest of the day. It doesn't apply. Those are calendaric days. And we're speaking about a malos. Malos means a period of time that's superimposed on the calendar, like a Zovo, or like a Nazir, or like one who's in Cherem, for a period of time, so let's say for a month, so then, or like Avela, Shiva, Shloshim, then you say Mikzei Yom Kukula, on the last day of the Malos, on the last day of the unit of time that superimposed on the calendar. But he said this is utterly ridiculous to apply such a principle to waiting 6 hours. He said he can envision those who would hold like that. He said he, in his family, he said they didn't have the practice. He said they wait 6 hours. But he said he can understand those who feel that it's enough if you wait into the 6th hour. Number one, because the Rambam writes kimoshe shots, approximately 6 hours. It doesn't say 6 hours. Then he said he understands what it means, because the Gemara says you wait, the father used to wait 24 hours. He says, I'm not so religious, I only wait from one meal to the other. So what does it mean, one meal to the other? So Rambam Soloveitchik said, let's say you have lunch approximately from 12 to 1. So let's say in Eretz Yisrael they have fleishiks for lunch. So you have fleishiks between 12 and 1, you finish eating the fleishiks at 5 to 1. Then you have supper between 6 and 7. So let's say you have milchiks for supper, so you don't have a full 6 hours. You just have from about 5 minutes to 1 till about 5 minutes after 6. So you start eating your milchiks. So it's a little more than 5 hours. And he says it has nothing to do, if there is such a practice, if there is such a minhag, he can understand it. He wouldn't say that it's improper. He said, but it's not based on the exam kukula. It's based on the idea that the time that it takes, the pause between one meal and the other, is a little bit over 5 hours, but it's not based on mixes and exam kukula. Some say like that, that avelas are tuma. The Gemara has it by tuma, by azava. The original pasuk is by azava, azava. You want to shake off the tuma, you want to shake off the avelas because it's very sick. So Rabbi Yosef Engel says that that's a mistake. He quotes early Achorim who say like that. And he says that he thinks that's a clear mistake because the Gemara applies mitzvah kukula to a nazir. And the nazir, it says in the Chumash, when he accepts nazirus upon himself, the Chumash says kadoshi yeh. He has a kedushas nazir. And nonetheless, the Gemara says, we paskin, that when it comes the morning of the 30th day, he can bring the kavanas in the base on the English and hack up and terminate the 30 days of the Naziris. He doesn't need a full 30 days. So you see from that Gemara, that's what the Yosef Engel discussed, what about by Hasana? Let's say you have Shiva Siman Ishta, that's also the shadow we had in the Yeshiva. I remember one of the boys got married, and he got bored, but he going to sit at home twiddling his thumbs all the time. So the last day of Shiva Siman Ishta, he came to the Yeshiva, and he came to Rabbi Soloveitchik Shir. So after the Shir, we dab in Mincha. So the question is, when you have a chassan, so you don't say tachna. So the question is whether we should say tachna. He already left. He left his home. He came to the yeshiva in the middle of the 7th day. So the question was, should you say mikta sayam kukulai on the 7th day of Avelus, just like you say mikta sayam kukulai on the chassan. On the 7th day of yeshiva is Imam Mishra, just like the din is in the Gemara, that you say mikta sayam kukulai on the 7th day of Avelus. So some of these early achronim, the Ramam in Tanu writes like this. He was in the Kubul. He writes, not Mixa and Kukul, like you said. Mixa and Kukul is only when you're dealing with Avelas, something said, or you're dealing with Tumna, the Zab, the Zoga, you want to shake off the Tumna as early as possible. When it comes to a Simcha, when it comes to a Chasanet, so it says in the Chumash, Malay Shavu Azov, fill in the full week. You don't want to hack up. You don't want to chop off any of the days. You want to have a full 7 days. So Rav Zalman actually thought that that was a joke. Someone mentioned it to him, and he thought that that made up his own idea, his own pasuk. Alesh was also, you don't apply, he thought that wasn't correct, like Rabbi Yosef Engel says that it's not correct because he tried it by Kedusha. The Nazir has Kedusha, Tzkodesh, he still, so Rechik said a different thing. He said that maybe by the Chassan, the Shiva Siman Ishta means that the Chassan is Meshuga to entertain his wife, to entertain the Caliph for the first week. So what do you mean? He decided on his own, he's coming to the Yeshiva, and he wants to terminate his obligation towards his wife. Maybe he has no right to, without his wife giving him permission to terminate the Shiva Siman Ishta. That's what he thought, that maybe he still has a din chasen until the end of the day, even though he left. He says he has no right to break off his obligations towards his wife without her permission. That was a different idea. There is a din in the Gemara that you're not permitted to bake fleishig bread or milchig bread. Let's say you're going to make bread with shmalzim in it. So you're going to make fleishig bread. So usually bread is eaten either with a meat meal or with a milchik meal, with a dairy meal. So if you're going to make a fleshy bread, milchik bread, someone may make a mistake and eat it with the wrong kind of a meal. Oh, so the Gemara says if you make it with a funny shape, a special shape, it doesn't look like a regular bread, so that is permissible, then it's okay. So there is a dispute in the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch, what if the bread looks like a regular bread? But on the package it says, chav kei, dairy. It says on the wrapper that it's milchik.
The bread is normal.
The bread, if you take the bread out of the wrapper, it looks like a regular bread. So many poskim are of the opinion, the Chavis Das, and many others, the Pischit Shuvah, and his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch quotes this, and Simen Tzadik Zayin, that's the last Simen in Hilchos Basa D'Cholot. So many say that minute you bake the bread, so it's already become treif. And then if you put a wrapper on it that says that this is a fleshy bread, this is a milky bread, it's not going to help. So Rav Soloveitchik said that his father used to paskin not so. His father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, held like Rav Yonis and Abishit. They quote there that in Tumim, the crazy place, it was of the opinion that a wrapper is also good. And the Pashtus is the Chochmas Sodom. Sounds like he paskins like that also. The Chochmas Sodom is a classic sefer on... Chochmas Sodom was a dying of Vilna. He was a Mechut of the Vilna Goyen. Not exactly Mechutin, is the Vilna Goyen is their grandchildren, married with the children of the Chochmas Sodom Chayyadim. So the Chochmas Sodom presents such a shayla that the Balabasta baked the chalas, the Shabbos, in the oven, and she had first baked the chickens. And then she took out the chicken, she baked the challah. She didn't realize that there was schmaltz that had spilled on the floor of the oven. And when she took out the challah, she realized that it was full of schmaltz, that it was fleshiks. So true, they only planned to eat fleshiks on Shabbos. They weren't going to have any milchiks. But the din is, you're not allowed to eat fleshik bread. The Gemara says, it's not like you're not allowed to have milchik bread. You're not permitted to have fleshik bread either. So now the bread became treif, so they can't even eat it with the fleshik meals on Shabbos. So everything was still burning hot. So the balabasta ran, and she asked the dayan, what should she do? The dayan was Rababa Lepasvel. He was a dayan during the lifetime of the Chochmas Sodom. So Abavala said, tell the woman quickly to take a piece of chicken and to stick it into the challah. So that will be the heker. That will be the siman. Everybody will see that this is a chicken, a fligal is sticking in the challah. So there also, the afriya, the baking of the challah was already completed. And nonetheless, he held that a heker, a siman that's made after the completion of the baking, is acceptable. So that's what Soloveitchik said. The other thing is that the Chokkei got into a lot of trouble with that because Balabatim were unhappy about that. What do you mean on the wrapper? They all know that, huh? I already forgot the whole history.
So after Sandra said it's straight, then he came on it.
But Rabbi Soloveitchik did say it. When we learned Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Soloveitchik said it, and then Rabbi Senter asked him specifically, can he give Hashgachah? He said yes. But then the Balabatim... Okay, then the Balabatim were upset about it. So that's why they stopped it. But his father's opinion was that it was Mutter. But today was the onset of Rabbi Shulchan Aruch.
What about Shulchan Aruch to be on the vegetables, the Ukraine, the broccoli,
to
the spinach? I know
that
I grew up in a modern Orthodox background. Nobody used to worry about
this. Right, nothing to do with modern... Okay, I'll discuss it now. The din is that you're not permitted to eat insects. It's not a kosher thing. So the Talmud says, the Gemara discusses the issue whether you have to check the vegetables to see if they have insects or not. You have a right to assume that if you don't see any insects that are invisible are okay. But if the insects are visible, just that I don't look, I take off my glasses and I can't see anything, so that's not considered invisible insects. So the question is, do I have to be concerned that maybe there are insects? And he say, no, whatever, if I don't see any insects, I don't have to worry about it. So the Gemara says that it depends how high a percentage, how high a likelihood there is that you're going to fall in and be eating an insect. If it's what we call a miut hamatsui, if it's a significant likelihood, then you're obligated to be bidding to check in advance to make sure that there are no insects. And if it's a miut she'ena matsui, if it's highly unlikely that you're going to be eating insects in this eating, so then you can ignore it. Then you don't have to check. What is the percentage that constitutes a miut hamatsui? What's considered the mere chain of matzah? So Rav Soloveitchik used to say that the Mishkan as Yankiv is a sefer that was written by a Litvish Adam Gadol. He was a student of Rav Chaim Valozhina. When they first started Valozhina Yeshiva, Rav Yankala Kalina, he came from Kalin, where all the Kalina Hasidim are, but he was a big misnaget. He has a few tshuvas where he attacks the Hasidim, he disagrees with different practices that they have. He used to have been machlokes some years ago. Now the Hasidim, the misnaget, everybody, those people live in peace and harmony together. The Hasidim and the misnaget, those machlokes in Aroma. Anyway, so Rav Yankala Kalina has a tshuva where he interprets the Gemara as meaning 10%. If there's a 10% likelihood, depends on how much cabbage or how many vegetables I'm going to eat. If I plan to eat 30 cabbages, so then there's a higher likelihood that I will be consuming a bug, as opposed to just eating a quarter of a cabbage or a third of a cabbage or something like that. So then there's a lower percentage. That depends how infested the cabbages are, what season of the year, what part of the world it is. So that's his clout. He thinks that if it's a 10% likelihood that you're going to be eating a bug, then you have to check the vegetable or the fruit, whatever it happens to be, in advance. And if it's less than 10%...
How thoroughly would you have to check? You have 10%, mm-hmm. 10% would have to look at under a couple of leaves, which is on top of each cabbage.
You've got to wash it all.
I'm not talking about washing, but you have to cut and look between every leaf, or just...
have to find out what the likelihood is that there may be bugs in the lower leaves, maybe bugs in the higher leaves. Usually if there are no bugs in the outer leaves, then for sure there are no bugs in the inner leaves. You're not permitted to eat dead insects either.
So you can't help them looking when they're dead.
Right.
They get close to the top of there, and the broccoli and the Brussels
sprouts. No, it's not so. No, it's not so. And in fact, that's a big problem. That's not a big problem. Do you know that the United States Department of Agriculture has pamphlets where they send you, upon request, they'll tell you about the nutritional value of different fruits and vegetables. So they tell you about the, they have on certain vegetables, they tell you about the, I already forgot what you call it. That's another thing. No, there's a certain a nutritional thing that's only found in meat.
Protein.
So they tell you what protein value there is in different vegetables on the assumption that you're consuming a certain percentage of insects. And that's not a joke. I saw the pamphlet. They send it out upon request. They tell you what the protein value is of eating certain vegetables. So that's the rule. If the likelihood is less than 10% that you will be eating trefis, the same thing for checking for sharpness. Are you obligated, if you buy clothing, are you obligated to check for sharpness? There could be sharpness in socks. Very often there is sharpness in socks with the golden tip socks by the toes. Sometimes there is sharpness. It can be sharpness in sweater, sharpness in anything. So is one obligated to check for sharpness or not? So it depends. Is there more than a 10% chance that you will be wearing a sharpness garment, or is it less than 10%? Less than 10% chance, so strictly speaking, you're not obligated to check. If there's more than 10% chance, so that's called the miyotam otzoi, then you are obligated to check. That's why we have a practice. It says in the Shulchan Aruch, when you shecht an animal, so you have to check to see if the animal had any diseases before the shechita that would render it as a trefa animal. So if you have to check for every single trefa, it'll take forever. You can spend a few days checking for trefa. We don't check for every single trefa. The only trefa that we check for is on the lungs to see if there are any serious. Manishtana, the trefa on the lungs, the trefa all over the body. So the Ramban, in his commentary on the Gemara Chulin, explains based on the Medrash that this is the reason why, because the trefa on the lungs, the serious on the lungs, is more than 10%. In fact, Rabbi Soloveitchik said it's 14%. You can tell. If you go to a slaughterhouse and you keep records of how many animals they couldn't sell as kosher because the shochet made a mistake and made a nevela, how many animals weren't acceptable because of trefus, so the percentage of trefus because of adhesions on the lungs, getting stuck, one lobe of the lung gets stuck to the other, these surfaces, but the adhesions was always 14%. Said Rav Soloveitchik for many years, part of his parnasa was that he gave a hechsher on the meats in Boston, because it's interesting, after his father passed away, after Rav Soloveitchik passed away, so he asked him to continue to say the shiurim in the yeshiva, but his mother had no parnasa. So he begged the board of the yeshiva that he should continue to send his father's check to the mother, and to make believe that that's the yeshiva policy, which at that time it was not, that they continue to support the almana as long as she lives. So he was getting no parnasa. He was teaching the yeshiva, he got nothing, because he told them they should send the check to his mother. And they shouldn't tell her that it's coming from him. They should make believe as if it's still. So he had no choice. He had to take on this position. His parnasa really was from giving the hashgach on the fleshy. So he said that there was some. He didn't insist on glatt kosher. Glatt kosher means that when you have a sircha on the ray, when you have an adhesion from one part of the lung to another, so glatt kosher means that it has no adhesions at all. And non-glatt kosher, the side of my machma, you have glatt kosher. Glatt means smooth. The lobes of the lung have to be smooth with no adhesions at all. And the Ramah is makel for the Ashkenazim that even if you have a sircha on the lungs, if you can rub it and peel it off, and then when you blow up the lung, you'll see that air won't come out from that point. So that shows that there was no hole at that point. So then there's no neket in the ray, so then it's kosher. That's the kula of the Ramah, the big kula of the Ramah. The Ramah has so many chumras in Shulchan Aruch on everything, especially Hilchos Shabbos, but he has this one kula that outweighs all of the chumras that he has. That's called the kula of miuch umishmush. If you rub and you rub and you remove the sircha and then you blow it up and you listen and the air doesn't come out, or you blow it up and you hold it submerged underwater, you don't see any bubbles coming out, so then you see that there wasn't a hole over there, so that's okay. But that's not called glatt kosher. That's not smooth because you had a sircha over there. Glatt means that it was smooth, you didn't have to remove anything. So the Ashkenazim are meikel on the non-glatt kosher. So Rav Soloveitchik used to make fun. He says that he gives a hashgacha in a slaughterhouse. That's not glatt kosher. The percentage of treifas because of Sirchas Anarei is 40%, and then the Glaukasha's slaughterhouses, they only had 8%. So he said, how is that possible? That's it. What, they have different behemoths? Their behemoths eat different grass. Where did they come from? They're eating the same grass that his behemoths are eating. He said, they're a bunch of fakers. It's not true. Not only is it not Glaukasha, it's not kosher at all. He says, you have to have. Normally, you have 14% of treifas due to Sirchas Anarei. So 14% is more than 10%, that's why you have to be poyek for the Sirchas Anarei. You don't have to check for any other kinds of treifas, because whatever other possibility of treifas, it could be in the heart and the kidneys and everything else, is going to be less than 10% of a likelihood, so that's why you don't have to check. That's why Rabbi Soloveitchik insisted on the not, on the non-glut kosher, he said on the non-glut kosher, he said that the calves in the springtime, when they graze outside, normally calves don't have so much seichel, so they'll bite into the fences that they have around the corrals, and they will swallow nails, and the nails will go into their kishkis, and will make holes in the kishkis. But that's also a treifas. If you have a nekiv and a bnei me'ayim, that also makes a treifas. So he ascertained that certain seasons of the year, he said in the springtime, certain seasons of the year, there's a higher than 10% likelihood of the calves having holes in the kishkis because of the nails that they swallow. So he insisted on a non-glut kosher. He said, that's the din. Whenever it's more than 10%, you have to check for it. It's not a lot of Moshe Messina that checking for treifas only applies to the sirchas on the lungs. It applies to any issue. Applies to checking for shatnas. Applies to checking for bugs on the fruits and the vegetables. Whenever there's a chance of more than 10% of the person violating an aveira, then Halacha says you have to check to ascertain that that you're clear, that you're not violating an aveira. So he, on his non-glut kosher, used to insist that in the springtime they have to check the calves to make sure that there's no sirch, there's no nekev on the bnei me'ayim. So what the issue that you raised about the vegetables that you raised before has nothing to do with the modern Orthodox. Or Moshe Feinstein may or may not have been modern Orthodox, depending on what your definition is. I think he was pretty modern Orthodox. He wrote a tshuva 40 years ago explaining that in America, since they spray all the vegetables when they're growing with pesticides, so you don't have to look for the bugs because it's highly unlikely that you're going to be eating any bugs. But in the more recent years, the last 10 years, the government doesn't allow them to spray anymore. So now we have tremendous number of bugs. You have all of these, many of these vegetables are infested with bugs, much more than 10% likelihood that you're going to be eating a bug. So it's not, how can it be that my grandparents ate it, and I have to be more religious than my grandparents? No, at the time my grandparents were eating it. In America, there was no problem because they were insect-free. And now the problem is back again. In Europe, over the country, in different parts of Europe, in different parts of America, different seasons of the year, sometimes you do have the problem, sometimes you don't have the problem. You have to ascertain. Whenever the problem is more than 10% likelihood that you will be violating an aveira, then you're not allowed to be lying on the road. Even though 85% likelihood is a rove, nonetheless it says in the Gemara that you're supposed to be b'edik l'chatchila, not just to be lying on the rove. That's an important clock. Beria achilu be'alaf lo'i bottom means like this. If I know for sure that a bug fell in and it got mixed in and it's I can't identify where it is, everything looks like a bug. So then you say, even if you have 1,000 chocolate chips and one bug and you can't figure out which is which, it's not bottled. But here we're not sure if we're eating a bug. In your case, we're sure we're eating a bug, but you say let it be bottled beroi. So you say there's no dinner big. Question is, if I'm eating part of a fruit or part of a vegetable, which may or may not, I'm eating one part of it, may or may not have a bug in it. I don't know if it has a bug. Maybe I'm not eating a bug at all, so I don't have to come on to people. The rule is, the chances are 80%, 85% that I'm not going to be swallowing any bugs. But since there's more than a 10% likelihood that I will be doing an aveira of eating a bug, so then it requires, you have to check, you need bedikah. That's what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. That's what Rabbi Soloveitchik used to conceptualize everything, and explained that it doesn't matter what it says. The case in the Shulchan Aruch is about checking the lungs. But it's not a din of checking the lungs. It's a din. Whenever there's more than 10% likelihood that you're going to be violating an aveira, then the din requires. That's called mil tamas. Then the din requires. You have to check in advance. The same thing checking for shatnas. And the same gemara, it's all based on a gemara in Pesachim, a totally different topic. The whole source of this issue is a gemara in Pesachim. The gemara has a question. Let's say the fellow comes to Yerushalayim on Erev Pesach. Erev Pesach in the daytime, and he rents a room. So the Gemara says, does he have the right to rely on the Frumah landlord, that the landlord was Bodei Chametz last night, when everybody was Bodei Chametz? Most religious Jews are Bodei Chametz on Leil B'dikas Chametz. Or should I say no? Maybe the landlord was relying on the future tenant who's going to come. So the Gemara asks this question. So the Gemara asks, what's the difference? Even if there is a role, even if one should assume that the likelihood is that the Truman landlord did the B'dikas Chametz, call up, pick up the telephone and ask the landlord whether he was by the Chametz or not. So what are we discussing? Whether you have a right to rely on the rogue. The rogue religious people who go to Chametz, Leil B'dikas, ask him and find out what the facts are. So the Gemara says, well, we're talking about a case that the landlord took off and he's not available and we don't know how to get him. So do we have the right to rely on the rogue? So the Mephoshim asks, why did the Gemara say, L'may nafkimina v'shayle, what's the difference whether the rogue is? That the former landlord would be but comes, why don't you ask him? No! If you have a right to rely on the rogue, then you don't have to ask him. So it's in that Gemara that the Mephoshim wall established this principle. That whenever you have a miut hamotzoi, there probably is more than 10% of religious people who would be renting out apartments who did not do B'dikas Chametz. So that's what the Gemara thought. If it's more than 10%, then you have to try to be mevarer in advance. It's not only a din of being bodik the siuches on the reya, it's a din all over, by B'dikas Chametz and by shatas and by everything.
What about can we figure out
that's the way he read the Gemara. The Gemara in Eilat Treifas talks about the bugs and the vegetables, so he interprets that the Gemara meant 10%. Rabbi Eliashiv in Eretz Yisrael today claims that he doesn't agree with him, he thinks the Gemara means 7.5%. Okay, but I think everybody usually assumes 10% is the cutoff one. If it's more than 10%, then it's considered a Niyat HaMotzei, then you have to be concerned about it. In the Shulchan Aruch, it's interesting, in Shulchan Aruch, the Rabbi Soloveitchik, I wouldn't say he was a machmer, I wouldn't say he was a mekel. He just used to call everything as, he used to decide everything the way, poshup shat, the way everything it did. He didn't have inclinations to be machmer, didn't have inclinations to be mekel. However, he thought the din was, that's the way he thought. So for example, in the Shulchan Aruch, it says by the milchik bread, you're not allowed to have milchik bread because somebody may make a mistake and eat it with the fleishik. So it says in the commentaries on the bottom of the page, in the tiny letters, in the fine print, that this is only on milchik bread. What about milchik cake, milchik cookies? So it says you don't have to be machna milchik cakes and cookies. If you have a cheesecake, so that's like a challah with the chicken in it. So you see the cheese is there. So that's like the bone of the chicken sticking in the heart. You can't make a mistake on a cheesecake. But let's say Mishkan cheesecake. I have a milchik cake or cookie. You can't really tell. Even by eating it, you can't really tell whether it's milchik or not. But we know, the Balbasta know that it's milchik. So in the commentaries and the fine print in the Shulchan Aruch, they say that the Gzeira and the Gemara doesn't apply because normal people don't eat cake or cookies with the flesh. Some of the children do. But normal adults don't eat the cake or the cookies with the flesh. The bread with the flesh they may eat. So since if the bread is milchik, you may eat it with the flesh. Or the bread is fleshy, you may by mistake eat it with the milchik. So then they made Gzeira the Rabbanan that we shouldn't allow it. But by cake or cookies, what is he really going to be violating? That he didn't wait 6 hours. He already finished eating the chicken. He's going to have a little chicken in his mouth and he's going to have the, by mistake, he's going to have a milchik piece of cake afterwards. So Basa de Gansa there, he violated a minute that he didn't wait the 6 hours. So it says, Nishgefella, that on cake and cookies, if it's you're not allowed to eat it, if you're still fleshy, you have to wait the 6 hours. But you don't make Gzeira the Rabbanan that you're not prohibiting eating milchik cake or cookies. So Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't like that. He said he heard from his father that it's not so, that you're not allowed to have milchik cake or cookies, period. So all the students started to scream, what are you talking about? So he said, no, cheesecake is a different thing, but the cheese is there. That's like the Chatmas Adam's case, where you have the piece of chicken sticking in. But he said, it's not a chunk of cheese in the cake, it's just that it has milk in it, or has butter. So he said he heard from his father that it's awesome. That's what he usually used to pass on everything based on what he heard from his father. One of the rabbis in the yeshiva, Rabbi Brandspiegel, was fond of telling over the story that Rav Soloveitchik's mother used to live across the street from the yeshiva for many years. Yeah. So he and Rav Soloveitchik used to always go to his, when he finished the yeshiva, go to his mother, spend some time, and then go to his own room. So on one occasion, Rabbi Brandspiegel was single then, so he had a shayla, and he went with Rav Soloveitchik to his mother's apartment, and he presented the shayla to the Rav. So Rav Soloveitchik said something. So his mother started to scream at him. His old mother started to scream, Daryl! She said in Yiddish, your father would never have fasting like that. So he got scared. He said, Akula. He said something as mutter. So she screamed, Daryl, your father would never fasting like that. I said, okay. He said, my father wouldn't say that at all. Sure. But that's usually the case. Usually everything that he used to say in Halach, he used to be from his father, from his grandfather. He didn't make up original things. Regarding the issue of the tuna fish, yeah.
Yeah, it is, so they that means you would have to wait.
Me, they bake milchik things in the same
oven.
In the same oven where they bake milchik. Not really. Oh, dairy. They mean they bake it on the same pans that they bake. Just in the same oven, that's not a problem. What is a problem is the following. In all of the bakeries where they do milchik, even in the most religious, where they do milchik pies, and part of the pies, there's always milk powder floating in the air. So they don't pour milk in, they take milk powder. And this stuff is like when you walk in, you can choke sometimes, it's floating in the air. So this milk powder always falls into the part of the dough as well. Now he's certainly going to have shishin, he's going to be bottled to shishin, he won't be able to taste it. But still, it's not right to declare it as part of it. That's the problem in all, even the most religious bakeries. They always have this powder floating in the air. On the tuna fish issue, the Mishnah says in Maseches Avodah Zarah that one is not, the Mishnah lists off different foods or beverages that one is not permitted to buy from a non-Jew. Because the non-Jews don't have to keep kosher. It's not from the Shevet Mitzvah's Beninah. So therefore, even if the non-Jew tells me that this is a kosher product, he's not to be trusted. You can only trust a person in an area of religious ritual if he's obligated to observe that law and he actually observes it. Let's say someone is very honest, but they don't keep kosher. And the person, a Jewish person, very honest person, never tell a lie, but he doesn't keep kosher. So such a person is not trusted on kashrus. Even though he would never tell me a lie or anything else, not. But if he doesn't keep kosher, so that's the din in the Talmud. If the person doesn't observe this area, so you can't trust him on that area.
Make a mistake so that
not only did they never have any non-kosher fish, not only did they never find any other kosher fish, they never found any other kind of tuna fish. If they're making skipjack, they'll never find any albacore. Not for religious purposes. That's the way they have their business set up. And fish, they're very marked that it should be dafka this kind of fish. You can't just slop them and throw all the fish together. It's not going to have the right flavor. They accept that this needs 9 minutes and this needs 11 minutes and so on and so forth. So that's what Avraham Soloveitchik used to say, that since they have a whole system worked out where they keep on checking, all the people are doing the checking on non-Jews, but they're checking it for the business purposes, and we've never heard that they're selling anything other than this. They said that's what it says in the Gemara. The Gemara said the Farish, if you have a Goyish company, we know that all they sell is this specific kind of fish, then you're permitted to buy there because the Yodua, that's all they sell. So Rabbi Genak once showed Rabbi Soloveitchik, used to be a big Talmud Chacham from Switzerland, Rabbi Breisch, who published a series of Shalos HaTshuvos that's called Chelkas Yachal, I think, I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Yanke Breisch. He was a Mechutan of the Minhas Yitzchok. The Mechutan, they had sometimes disagreements about the halacha issues. So the Chelkas Yaakov has a tshuva about the tuna fish, where he argues the whole case, that they check and so on. The Rabbi Genak once showed it to Rabbi Soloveitchik. He says, Dusa tach mein tshuva, dusa dir gezot, that's what I said, exactly like that. Since they check it so many times, chazok umal amara nasa, so he thought that that you can rely on the tuna fish. There are some rabbonim who are still tumbling about this, that you're not allowed to buy regular tuna fish. So for quite a period of time, my father, he should be well, was in charge of the supervision in the yeshiva cafeterias, all the three cafeterias, in Stern College, and in Einstein, and in the yeshiva, in the main center. So they always used to use regular tuna fish. And then one of the rabbis in the yeshiva made such tumma about the tuna fish, so he insisted, they didn't consult my father, they insisted that they're going to only buy the dagim that they check. So they put up a sign in the cafeteria, that from now on, they're not going to carry any regular OU tuna fish, only going to have dagim. Rabbi Soloveitchik always used to eat in the cafeteria, till the later years when he wasn't well, he had to eat in his own room. He always used to eat, so he came into the cafeteria one fine day. Sees a sign that they're not having the regular tuna fish, so he called in my father. He said, what's this, something new? What's wrong with the regular tuna fish? It was very asked. My father said, he didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't know that they switched. But then he found out that they hadn't asked a chumrah. They didn't consult my father. They decided they're going to have only the dagim with the special supervision. So Rabbi Soloveitchik felt that it wasn't necessary. He said he personally doesn't eat tuna fish. If he asked him, does he? He said he doesn't enjoy the flavor of tuna fish. He doesn't like the taste. But he showed people that in his home, in Boston they had it because his grandchildren used to like the tuna fish. And in yeshiva, he said, you're permitted to have the tuna fish. He said, the din in the Mishnah doesn't apply in this kind of a case. On Bishul Lachem is also an issue. The Talmud says that if a non-Jew cooked food, and I was watching the way my next neighbor cooks the food. It's a kosher pot and kosher ingredients, everything is kosher. So the rabbis prohibited us from eating the food, lest this will lead to too much friendship with the non-Jews. There's nothing wrong being friendly with non-Jews, but eating the food that they cook may lead to a different kind of relationship. It may lead to intermarriage. That's what the rabbis of the Talmud were concerned about. So that was the main reason why they prohibited eating bishul akum, food that's cooked by a non-Jewish person. So the question is, all of the canned goods that we buy that are cooked, they're all cooked by non-Jewish people or companies. So some
restaurants,
that's also a problem. A lot of people have chefs in their home who are non-Jewish chefs, so you have pocket problems. So the question on the can, so some poskim from the 1700s were of the opinion that since this is manufactured in a very impersonal fashion, I don't know who the fellow is, and I'll never find out who his daughter is. With me, I'm gonna marry his daughter in order to have Abe Kikest. He should always give me this delicious tuna fish. I don't know where he lives, in Pago Pago somewhere. Till I'm gonna find Pago Pago, my son will already have a different worker. Yeah, there's no shyness over this. And some poskim were of the opinion that if it's so impersonal like that, so far-fetched, he lives on the other side of the world, and I'll never find out who he is. It's not shyness to lead up to intermarriage. So somehow that was mutter. So Rabbi Soloveitchik thought that that was not correct. He thought that that was not correct. And that's the generally accepted opinion. We're usually machmer on that. We are mitzar of that opinion. If you have other tzadim lahav, we have other considerations. Why did he make all? So that's also counts as one. Usually when it comes to bishul akum, so you mitzar two or three tzadim lahav. You don't have an outright hetzer. But Rabbi Soloveitchik had a different hetzer. He thought that all of these canned goods would never be oil al shulchan malachim. They would never be served in a royal banquet there at a chasana when you have a wedding, so you never serve this kind of stuff. You cook all the vegetables anew. You don't take gefilte fish from a jar and serve it. You have to cook special. special fish, don't make something specially. And the Gemara says the only time the Chacham prohibited the bishalachim, the food that was cooked by the non-Jew, is if it's such a choshev amachal that it would be oila al shulchan malachim, that it would be served in a royal banquet. This is what the Chaim Oizi used to say in Europe, that all the canned goods are not oila al shulchan malachim. The Chazanish was famous, he didn't follow that kula. He thought that oila al shulchan malachim means something else. Rabbi Schwab was fond of telling over this story, that Rabbi Schwab Zichron LeBracha from the Breuer's community had a brother who lived in Bnei Brak. So every so often he would visit Eretz Yisrael to visit his brother. So he said the first time he visited his brother, the Chazanish already lived in Bnei Brak, he had never heard of the Chazanish. Chazanish lived in Vilna, he had never heard of him. In Europe he was an unknown person, just Rabbi Chaim Loza knew who he was. Rabbi Chaim Loza used to consult a lot with him on halacha, on politics and everything. But to the public he was an unknown figure. When he came to Eretz Yisrael the first couple of years, he was also pretty unknown. Rabbi Schwab said not until his second visit Bnei Brak had he heard of the Chazanish. And then when he heard of him, so then he went with a whole shopping list of questions that he wanted to ask him about halacha issues. So he said first, he carried on a whole pleasant conversation, and then when he said, can I ask you a few shabbos, he said the Chazanish became very dead serious, and he said, okay, yes. And he had a very stern look on his face, and then he asked the question, he gave him an answer, yes, no, asa, muta, no more friendly conversation, just gave an absolute psak. So he asked him, what about the sardines, the canned sardines? This was, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. So he said, what about canned sardines? So he said, awesome. So he was going to ask him, but Rav Chaim Moshe held that it was mutter, thinking that the Chazanish is kafuk to Rav Chaim Moshe, because Rav Chaim Moshe is the one who made the Chazanish famous. No one had heard of him. Rav Chaim Moshe is the one who said that this man is an Adam Gol, you should ask him what he used to correspond. He used to ask him shilas. Rav Chaim Moshe sent shilas to the Chazanish when he was already in Eretz Yisrael. He used to send him the shilas, he should send it back to Psak to Europe. He relied on the Chazanish so much. So Rabbi Schwab started to say, but then he chapped himself. What's he going to say? You know, Rabbi Chaim Moshe says it's mutter. So he said, but you know, there are others who hold that it's permissible because it's not oil ashul malachim. So he said, the Chazanish said, what do you mean? The Queen of England needs it every day for her breakfast? So Chazanish was of the opinion that oil ashul malachim doesn't mean that it will be served in a royal banquet. It means, is it so cheap a michael that a king or a queen would never eat it, even when they're eating breakfast on their own? Or no, oil ashul malachim means that the Queen of England would eat it. The Queen of England would eat it, just that he would never serve it in a royal banquet. So that was his definition. But Rabbi Soloveitchik held the definition like Rabbi Chaim Moshe, that oil ashul malachim means, would you serve it in a chasana? Would you serve it in a royal banquet? He thought that all the canned goods, there's really no shayla of bishulakam on them. The Yo-Yo tries to work out that all of the canned goods they rely, that's one of the Dvarim Lahakal they rely on, but they usually try to have more coolness than that. They wouldn't just rely on that. Cholav Akum is a din in the Mishnah. Cholav Akum, the Mishnah says, one is not permitted to purchase milk from a non-Jewish farmer if there were no Jews watching when the goy was milking the cow. Why? So the Gemara says, because we are concerned that maybe they mixed in some non-kosher milk. Unless you know for sure that they don't have any non-kosher animals on this whole farm, it's not checked. There's nothing to be concerned about. So in Europe, up until the Second World War, all the Jews were medactic. The people would walk miles in order to watch the way they would be milking the cows, in order to get cholav itself. They wouldn't buy cholav akum. In America, where you have everything is done by machinery, and now in Eretz Yisrael, also many countries, they don't milk the cows by hand. Everything is done by machine, and it goes into a big tank. If you ever visit in the kibbutzim in Eretz Yisrael, so they give you a grand tour. So they just hook up. These machines are only the size of cows. The machine wouldn't fit if you put it on a pig. The big machines only fit for the udders of a cow. And then the milk goes into the machine, it goes into the big tank, and it goes from that tank to another tank. The whole thing goes automatically. It's untouched by human beings. No one ever touches it. So what you have to say that you're concerned over here that maybe they mix in some non-kosher milk? We know what the system is in America and in Europe and in Western. Still, they carry the milk down in buckets. When I visited Switzerland, I saw by the Chazal Asif, the girls carry the milk down in the buckets in the tails from the top of the mountain. Takes them a couple of hours till they get down to the bottom. So it's not all done by machine. But if you have everything done by machine, so Rav Soloveitchik thought like Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Chazanish also thought like that. That the whole din of cholav akum doesn't apply. It's interesting, one of the Hungarian rabbanim who lives in Bnei Brak now, Rabbi Vosner, writes in his sefer that the Chazanish said that the cholav akum is mutter today, if you have such a system. And he was very appalled by the Hungarians. This is like the most important thing, cholav akum and bishul akum, this is the most important parts of the Kashrut, and he says, he writes that he pleaded with the Chazon Ish not to make public. All right, even if you're right, but don't let people know what you're thinking. He said, what do you mean don't let people know? I got to give my honest opinion. He was always oblivious of what's politically correct or incorrect. He would always say whatever he thought the thing was. In fact, that's what it is.
Wasn't there a issue of one question points out about the policy of Israel or Baku?
Yeah.
And that because today the government controlled the provision of the milk because of testing and so forth, they're going to rely on it. I don't think that may have been before the time that all these machines became universal.
Right.
40, 50 years ago, it was universal. But he said that because the government checks.
Right.
Therefore,
you can rely on it. Yeah. Rav Moshe in the later years, you should avoid it. They printed the later truth that he wrote maybe 10 years before he passed away. He wrote a letter to Rabbi Ox from Toronto, encouraging him that he should give the hechsher, and he says that now people should avoid drinking the regular milk. He thought that it was only a cooler, and you should avoid using the cooler.
Rav Moshe thought not so. Maybe there's another reason why, because it was juridically a
Gezeirah. Rav Moshe Minyan.
Yeah, so what you need is
right.
I mean, judicially, that's a problem with that particular
debate. Right, so that's what Rav Soloveitchik said, and that's what the Hazanish said. But the Gemara itself says that if it's absolutely no chashash, there's nothing to be concerned about. They just don't have any non-kosher animals on the farm. Well, they have non-kosher animals, but the way the system is set up, it's not shaykh that the milk could have come from the non-kosher animal to these tanks. Everything goes automatically. So then Rav Soloveitchik thought that you wouldn't even need a bezin to abolish the Gezeirah. Built into the Gezeirah itself was this heaven. Regarding the cheese that's manufactured by the non-Jews, the Mishnah records that the rabbis, the Tanoim, made a special Gezeirah derabbanan. They prohibited eating cheese that was manufactured by non-Jews. And the Mishnah doesn't give any reason. And the Mishnah tells the story that one of the Tanoim was absent when they introduced this Gezeirah. And he met one of the others who was present, and he said, oh, you just made a prohibition against the cheese, what's the reason? So he started hadraying him the thing, he started talking about a pasuk in Shir Hashir, and he told him the Dech and the Yom, he didn't give him the answer. So the Gemara says, why didn't they tell him the reason? So the Gemara says, whenever the Chachamim made a Gzeirah, they wouldn't divulge the reason to anybody, even one of the rabbis who was invited to the meeting, but he just didn't show up, they wouldn't give the reason, they wouldn't publicize the reason for a year, until everybody would be observing the Gzeirah, because if they're going to tell everybody the reason, everybody will pass it on their own. That's the reason. No, that doesn't apply to me. That applies to the other. The Pashat of Balabatan doesn't apply to me. I'll know that this is Mutta, this is Asa. So they didn't want to tell them the reason. So after many years, the reason was forgotten. So in the days of the Amoraim, the Gemara gives six different suggestions. What's the real reason? What's wrong with this cheese that's manufactured by the non-Jews? So the popular reason that's generally accepted is Matnei Shemamina Moshe B'Yorkei V'Snezeilom. Renin. So they put in the tray for renin to convert the milk into cheese. And the tray for renin, even though you have shishim against it, well over shishim, you have 1,000 times shishim. Dovah Mamin, so Dovah Mamin is not bottled. That's the generally accepted opinion. But Taisus quotes the Rabbeinu, one of the other reasons in the Gemara, Taisus quotes the Rabbeinu Tamna says that we really talk about one of the other reasons in the Gemara, namely, that the reason why you're not allowed to eat the cheese that's manufactured by the non-Jews is because in that area there was a concern that it was very common that there were a lot of snakes in Eretz Yisrael. Some of these snakes were poisonous. Whatever they would drink, whatever the snakes would nibble into or would drink, any food or drink, they would sometimes spit out poison from their body into the food or into the drink. So if there would be mayim legulim, if there would be water that would be uncovered for a period of time where there was a possibility that a snake may have come and taken a sip. Not mayim shalom, mayim legulim, it's called. Something like that, not the same. If you have mayim legulim, so you're not allowed to drink it because of the concern that maybe the snake spit in some poison into that. So we're not concerned about that now. Let's say we have a bucket of water and nobody was watching it. We'll drink the water because we don't have any in the middle of New York. There are no snakes, even in the mountains, there are no snakes in New York. And even snakes, they don't spit out any poison. We don't have these kind of snakes today. So we're not medactic about that. So the Rabbeinu Tam says that that's the reason why we're talking that the cheeses are prohibited, because in the days of the Tanoim, the non-Jews in that community where they made these cheeses, the Mishnah says where the city was. So it's not a fact. I mean, it's based on Nike. I don't know exactly what that corresponds to. So the Goyim used to manufacture these cheeses, used to mix in some water, they were not careful with the water. It would be water that was Megula that could have been poisonous. So that's why you're not allowed to eat the cheeses. So the Rabbi Natan says that doesn't apply today because we all drink Maimagulam. So the Rabbi Natan says the whole prohibition of the cheese doesn't apply, provided that you know that all the ingredients are kosher. If the taka makes the cheese with non-kosher rennet, so trace. If you don't need a xerah, then it's really trace. We're talking, what if it's microbial cheese? Most of the cheeses, they don't use rennet, they use microbes. No, most of them keep on changing back and forth. But now most of the cheeses are made with imitation, microbial rennet, not with real rennet. So it's not trace. So that's the question. It says in Shulchan Aruch, what if you have cheese that we know was made with kosher rennet, not with non-kosher rennet, but it was made by non-Jews?
What is non-kosher rennet? When I learned from the Torah, it seems that they call it Pirkei Avot. And rennet is called Pirkei Avot.
No, that's something else, no. The rennet is the lining on the inside of the stomach. You're referring to something else. The Chol of Shebekeva, when a calf drinks milk from a mother, so it has a belly full of milk, so the enzymes in the stomach, within a half an hour, less than half an hour, the enzymes will have such an effect on the milk inside the calf's stomach that it will be so icky that no one in his right mind will want to eat it.
That's called the stomach they can't choose from.
Now you can take some of, if you make it, now, if you take some of that cheese from the stomach, that icky stuff, and you throw that into milk, that will also convert it into cheese. That's okay. But if you take the lining from the stomach, and you throw that, the rennet is an enzyme that's given out by certain glands on the inside of the stomach. So the milk that's in the belly is full of that enzyme, full of that rennet. So if you take any of that milk and you throw it into milk and convert it into cheese, that's okay, because that's Pirshut Yama. That's Nifsal Me'achilo. That's no problem. What if you take a piece of flesh? In the days of the Gemara, they used to cut out a piece of the stomach, and the piece of the stomach had on the lining of the stomach, it had this rennet on it. And then you throw the shtick flesh into the milk, so then it would make it basa b'chalav. That's the difference between amidim b'kevam, amidim b'or ha'kevam. If the amidim b'kevam means the chalav shall be kevam, that's pirsha b'yavam. So Rabbi Soloveitchik's practice was, he must have had a family tradition, in Shir he never discussed this at all. But everybody knows that his practice was, he used to eat regular Kraft cheese. He used to eat regular, until it found out that the Kraft cheese was really trace. Then he almost fainted. He always worked on the assumption that they're not using non-kosher rennet, that they're using microbial rennet or something else. And then one of the boys from Yeshiva sent a letter to Kraft, and he wanted to know, how do they make the cheese? What do they use? Do they use this? Do they use that? So they sent back a letter. No, I think Rav Kefet sent the letter, if I'm not mistaken. That was 40 years ago, 35 years ago. He said, no, we use prime, grade A, quality beef. They take out the... So they showed Rav Soloveitchik the letter. He almost said that the cheese that he was eating was always straight. And he was working on the assumption that the cheese, the ingredients in the cheese were kosher, but still, what do you do? It says in Shulchan Aruch that it's oster, that even if they use microbial rennet, you're not allowed to eat the cheese. So his opinion was, I think he had a family tradition on this, that we pass on like the Rabbi Natan, that it's mutter, but it's halacha v'emorim came. You're not allowed to pass on like that in public. So when people would eat in his home, they saw he ate Kraft cheese. Everybody would eat the Kraft cheese. But then other people would see these people, what are you eating, Kraft cheese? They said, that's Rabbi Soloveitchik. The people would call him up on the phone and he would say, no, it's today, and he would hang up the phone. And they never got to ask him, but you yourself eat it. They never got it. He would hang up the phone all the time. They told me that rabbis lost their position over this. They told me more than one rabbi saw Rabbi Soloveitchik ate the Kraft cheese. I said, what does he have to spend so much money for kosher cheese? If the Kraft cheese is half the price, so he bought regular cheese. So the Balabatim got angry. What kind of an Orthodox rabbi is this? So they wanted to fry the rabbi. So the rabbi said, but you saw Rabbi Soloveitchik eat it. So the Balabatim called Rabbi Soloveitchik. He said, no, it's today. The Gemara has such a concept. The dinner, there's something in mutter, the ain't more came, but you're not allowed to pass in it. So Rabbi Soloveitchik, a lot of times, in his humility, he may have made a mistake. He thought that what he does in his private home, that's his private business. A lot of people didn't consider his private business. Whatever he did, they watched every sneeze that he did, and they assumed that that's a tzak. That was his tzak, that is mutter, but he didn't say like that. And in later years, when Rabbi Ganak was involved in the kashrus of the Orthodox Union, they would have, once in a while, they would have an issue by mistake. Someone had a pizza shop, and he used microbial rennet, where all the ingredients are kosher, but the cheese was made by non-Jewish people. So they had a shayla where everything became trefil, you have to throw it all out, then you can be mekel. So Rabbi Soloveitchik wouldn't tell him that it's mutter. He was working on the premise that it's trefil, that you're not allowed to use the non-Jewish cheese. And he would try to work out with the rules and regulations of the Shulchan Aruch at Sad Lahakam, to try to figure out Why one can he make them? But the cheese made big problems years ago. There is an issue that we touched on that is also relevant, let's say, all of the cosmetics and medications for Pesach. So a lot of them contain chametzik ingredients. So we get these Pesach directories with a list of all of the medications that they have to have for them, a chametzik and so on and so forth. So Rabbi Soloveitchik used to laugh at the whole thing and said, what do you mean? The thing is not Roy Lachilov Kelev, there's nothing to discuss. The other Rabbanim didn't know the secret that it's not Roy Lachilov Kelev, it's a din in the Shulchan Aruch. So the reason why the others were machmir is because when you study Yeridaya, the Chavis Das, the Nesivus writes in Yeridaya, that when food becomes nitzal me'achilas kelev, it's not edible for a dog, it's mutter, that's only if it rotted, if it became spoiled by itself. What if I have alcohol, chametzik alcohol, and I mix in ingredients that make it nitzal me'achilas kelev? On its own, it didn't spoil, it didn't rot. I mixed in things that make it not Roy Lachilos Kelev. So the Chavis Das writes that there's no heter in such a case. That's called Oichel Shelo Kederach Achilosa, which is Aser Midirabbanan, but that's not called Nifsim Achilos HaKelev. And they quote the same in the name of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim doesn't have it in the Sefer, but the Chidush Rav Chaim that they wrote over in his name, they have in the end of Gemara Nozir a hope shot based on that premise. So Rav Soloveitchik thought that didn't make any sense. He never heard that his grandfather said like that. He thought that didn't make any sense. It doesn't make any difference whether it became spoiled and rotted on its own, or you mixed in an ingredient and you made it nifsim achilas hakelev. That's how the Chazanish also writes. He doesn't think that the Chavis Das is right. It doesn't make a difference how it became non-royal achilas hakelev. It's right now, it's not royal achila. So it's mutter and shy. I remember on one occasion, one of the boys asked Rav Soloveitchik, because he... Because Rav Soloveitchik didn't always, after Shir, he was very exhausted, so it wasn't the right time to ask him any shaylos. You have to ask when he's relaxed and able to absorb the shaylos. I remember once a student was asking him, he had some kind of a medication he has to take in a gelatin capsule. So he wanted to know, is he allowed to take it? And then the student was asking, since he swallows the capsule. He doesn't chew it, he swallows the capsule, so he's not really eating the trachis, he's only swallowing it. So that's the question that the student asked Rabbi Soloveitchik. They said, it's mutter, you can take it. So one of the other students asked, is it mutter because he swallowed it? Because the one who asked, Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't listen to the whole question. The one who asked it said, am I allowed to take the gelatin capsule because I swallow it and I don't chew it? I'm not going to chew it. So Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't listen to the chewing story. It just says mutter. So another student didn't want the first guy to have the mistaken impression, he shouldn't walk away. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, no, that's not the reason why it's mutter. It has nothing to do. Some parts can say if you swallow and you don't chew, that's not considered achila. That's called shalukadarach. They said that's not correct. He didn't. They say based on the Gemara, matzah. The Gemara talks about bala matzah as opposed to bala mara. If you swallow matzah without chewing it, then you are yotze. But if you swallow mara without chewing it, then you're not yotze. So in order to understand what's the difference between matzah and mara, so some commentaries on the Gemara claim that whenever you eat food without chewing it, you just swallow chunks without chewing it. That's called shalukadarach achila. So Rav Soloveitchik said no, that's a joke. He doesn't think that that's correct. Even a lot of times in discussion of halacha, he burst out into laughter. He says, it's ridiculous. Even he just started laughing. So he said, he thought this was ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense. If he said, a lot of people swallow things without chewing. That's kosher. Look at that. So he said, that's not correct. He said, it's a different reason, and he's not obligated to give the reason. That was another big problem by him. He said, the halacha says, the halacha, he quoted, we were learning Sanhedrin at that time. So he showed, when you have a din Torah, let's say, people came for a din Torah on their own. Out of their own free will, they came to the they submitted themselves to the Bezdin. The Bezdin gives a psak, so the Bezdin is not mechuyev to give them the reason for the psak. They just say, this is the psak in Friday. If we forced you to appear before us, you didn't want to go to our Bezdin, you wanted to go somewhere else, you didn't want to go at all, and we forced you to appear, so then if you insist, kisuli, neheza tam tantuna, you insist, you want to know the reason, so then the Bezdin is obligated to supply the reason for the psak. But if you submitted on your own, you submitted yourself on your own for the psak, so then the Bezdin is not going to give you the reason. So Rabbi Soloveitchik used to apply this to Shilas as well. A lot of Rabbanim used to have that attitude, like Rabbi Dick also had such an attitude. People asked him a Shilas, he would say the Din. But then you would say, is it this reason? So I'm not going to give you the reason. Not going to you ask me the Shilas, that's the Din. This caused a lot of trouble, because Rabbi Soloveitchik just said a Din, and then everyone, 100 people would interpret it in 100 different ways, because they wouldn't know the real reason. So he said over here, the reason is not because you swallow it as opposed to chewing. He thought that that was a joke. He said, it's a different reason, he's not going to give you the reason. No, it's not so difficult to figure out the reason, but he didn't say a reason, so we don't have to discuss it. Rather, today, one of the boys came over to me with the following shayla, which we had in class when we were discussing the letter Yeridaya, Soloveitchik discussed this in class. What's the din? So I understand that a guy just got married and they just made a knife tray. They had a little knife and they made it, they mixed it with leishik shem. Okay. So he has to kasha the knife. But he doesn't know which knife it is. They have a whole bunch of knives. They just got married. Like, what do you have? Service for six? Service eight? Have service for four. And service for four. So he has one tray for knife got mixed in with three kasha knives. So the din is that it should be buffed, right? The question is, though, maybe this is a double sheishal matirin. Why should you say that it's bottle beroyin and you don't have to kasher? I have a simple solution. Kasher over four knives. It's simple. So it says in the Shulchan Aruch, no, that since it's such a tirche, the kasher, the four knives, so that's not called double sheishal matirin. That's what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. So when we're learning this in Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Soloveitchik said at that time, did any... He said, Rabbi Yosef Karo lived in Eretz Yisrael in Tzfas. Did anybody ever visit Tzfas? I never heard of Tzfas. So I said, no one knew what he was driving at. So he said, Tzfas is on top of the mountain. He says, he didn't understand this sit in Shulchan until he visited Eretz Yisrael. He says, Tzfas is on top of the mountain. And when he visited Eretz Yisrael, 1935, whatever, 36, I don't know, whatever already. So he said, at that time, they didn't have water that went in a pipe. So you had to buy the water from the Arabs. The Arabs used to slop up the water. So it cost a lot of money. It's got to get a bucket of water. So you're going to have to waste a couple of dollars in order to cash in the four knives. So that's the din, that's the double sheish patircha. But he says, in America, you just turn on the faucet and you get all the water you want. So why is that a double sheish patircha? So he says, in America, that psak doesn't apply. He said, you have to cash in all the four knives. So I told the boy today, you have the shaper. The rabbi's all rich, he said, you have to cash in all the knives. In Shulchan Aruch, there is a din that when you bake bread or cake or cookies, you're supposed to be mafish chal. Some people make a mistake, they think that you only have to be machish challah when you're baking challah, when you're making bread. It's not so. In the Mishnah, in the Gemara, it says you have to be machish challah even when you're making cake or cookies as well. So the Gemara says, the Mishnah says the Chiddush, that this, the Min HaTorah, the laws of challah only apply in Eretz Yisrael, doesn't apply outside of Eretz Yisrael. But the Rabbanan, they instituted all over the world because the Jews went into Golus and they thought it's going to be a Golus that's going to last for quite a few centuries, so we're going to forget the whole mitzvah of challah. So they introduced the mitzvah of hashish challah all over the world. But the Gemara says, because it's only chutz lorets, so there are many, many kulis, chalas chutz lorets, over chalas eretz yisrael. So Rabbi Soloveitchik related that he heard from his mother, that he heard a lot of dinim from his mother. He'd stay over sometimes, yes. So he said he heard from his mother that when she got married to the son of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, he told her, soon after they got married, Rav Chaim told his mother soon after they got married, that when she makes sponge cake, she doesn't have to be machmen to be mafish chalas. Because there is a dispute in the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, what if he just had a blila raka? It's not a thick dough, it's a batter that pours. So there's a dispute if you only have a batter that pours easily, even though you're going to bake it later on, is that chayv and chalas? On the Shulchan Aruch it says yes. It says even though it pours, it's liquidy, but if you're going to bake it, so it is chayv and chalas. But many gedolim held not so, that it's not chayv and chalas. So he said, Rav Chaim told his mother that in chalas kutzlaris you can be mekel. If you live in Eretz Yisrael, it's a different thing, that you should be machmer. But he said, in chalas kutzlaris you can be mekel, that you don't have to be machish chalas on sponge cake. Rabbi Soloveitchik mentioned...
Isn't that any
amount of chalas supposed to be? Yeah, for sure. Yes, you just bake a little bit, then there's no chiyuv chalas at all. Yeah, usually what's generally assumed is between 3 and 5 pounds of flour, you mafish challah without a broch. And if you use more than 5 pounds of flour at one shot, then you mafish challah with a broch. That's what's usually... Right, right. But the question is, what if it's a very loose batter? It's not a thick dough that you need with your hands. You pour it. So that's the question. So that's a big dispute. Blila rakam, that's called the blila rakam as opposed to blila oval.
And what's the marker of that type of?
It's a whole discussion, Tesis with the Ramban, with the Shaila, how we paskin, yes. Rabbi Schwab used to paskin like that for Breuer's bakery, but I think now they no longer rely on that cooler because years ago Breuer's was a local insulated hashgach only for the Balabat and their community, but now they sell all over, they sell
That's another story.
But now that they sell to others, and others don't follow necessarily the kulas of the chumers of Breuer, so now they have to introduce this chumer as well. Rabbi Soloveitchik said that he remembered in America that the Agudas HaRabbanim wanted, there were many Jewish bakers who stayed open on Shabbos, used to bake on Shabbos, And the Agudas HaRabbanim wanted to answer all of that bread that was baked on Shabbos, the Jews are not allowed to buy it. Because if a Jew does malach on Shabbos on behalf of someone else, he's not allowed to get halach from that malach. And then they wanted to ask any bread that's baked within 24 hours after Shabbos is over, because there's a bliya in the oven, in the baking tins, there was a bliya from these breads that are trade for all the customers, anyone wants to buy it. So for the first 24 hours, that bliya should make trade for all of the other bread. So they wanted to ask any religious Jews from buying any bread that was either baked on Shabbos or baked 24 hours into Sunday, after Shabbos was over. So he said, Rav Soloveitchik said that his father made such a tumult, he didn't let the Agudas HaRabbanim introduce this Isser. And he disagreed with the 2 points. So he said that the Din in Shulchan Aruch, the Nishan Asa B'Shvilo, if an Avera was done, there's a penalty that I'm not allowed to get Hanor from, and even the person on whose behalf I did it, it's also not allowed to get Hanor. This originally only appears in Shulchan Aruch and in the Gemara with respect to a different din in Yerodea. They mevat on Yisrael HaChili. Not allowed to pour in a little bit of traces into food, even though you know it is empty, you're going to have shishim. But then it says in Shulchan Aruch that if you did mix it in and you made a bikkul b'shishim when you weren't allowed to, so then even though you have bikkul b'shishim, you're not allowed to use the bikkul because of the penalty of the Rabbanah. And then it says in Shulchan Aruch, even the customers on whose behalf it was done, also not allowed to be nene. So Rabbi Zerushar Moshe Soloveitchik explained why that kanas, that it even applies to the customer, that should only apply by Eim of Atalish Lachatchila, but not by Hilchas Shabbos. Okay, it's getting late, so I'll leave out the explanation. But that's what he held, that it really shouldn't apply to Hilchas Shabbos. The one with Mahal Shabbos, for him there's a penalty if he's interested in being religious. For him there's a penalty that he shouldn't need it. But the customers were not Mahal Shabbos, for them there shouldn't be a penalty. And then he disagreed on the second point, and the Mishnah Berurah already quotes those who disagree, to say that even if one were to assume that the bread that was baked on Shabbos is also for Mishan Asa B'Shvilo, for all the customers, they're going to say, therefore, there's a bli of treifus in the baking tin, and whatever breads or cake or cookies you're going to bake on Sunday within 24 hours is going to be on this and time Nishrat, so the bli of kelim is going to make usher. But he said his father held that that's a very shvera chumrah. He said you shouldn't be machma like that. It's not really treif, it's a knas, not to be nene from Alech Hashem. So if I'm going to eat the cake or the bread that was baked on Sunday, that has a clear from the bread or the cake that was baked on Shabbos. It makes it taste better. The bread or the cake that's baked on Shabbos is going to taste the same with the blia from yesterday's bread or without the blia from the... It doesn't enhance the flavor. So it's not called Nedim of Alecha Shabbos, and it's not considered Maholos Hasur, that it's not considered treifus, that you should say that it has a blia of treifus, that it should answer up the bread. So he thought on both accounts that this chumra was not correct. So Soloveitchik was known every Pesach, even a month before Pesach, he used to give a shiur for the Rabbanim, for the Rabbinical Lama of the Yeshiva, every year to something about Pesach. So every couple of years he would go through the laws of kashering again, Hagolah and Libun. So every time he would go through the dinim, he would express his opinion about kashering an oven for Pesach. So he would say that even though our ovens only go up to 550 degrees, they don't go up to Libun. Libun really needs 950 degrees. 1,000 degrees heat, it's not enough 550 degrees. So he said that for Pesach, his opinion was that you could be mekel, and he used to give his explanation why. That one opinion in Tosfos and the Shulchan Aruch is that chametz before Pesach is what we call a terebola, everything is kosher. So he's preventing, it's not that it's trade when you try to kosher it, it's kosher now, you want to prevent it from becoming trade. So whenever anything is a terebola, so you never need libun, hagola would be enough. And whenever hagola is enough, and you want to use libun, so libun kal would be sufficient, but Kal would be 550 degrees. So that's one explanation. Then he said, and even if one should assume the way we are machna, that we treat chametz before Pesach as Yisura Bola, it's not a terrible bola, and you do need the libun, but there are those who are of the opinion that the sacred bola kach polta. Since I never used the chametz and anything higher than 550 degrees, when I was baking all year long, the highest that the ovens go is 550 degrees, so there are some who are of the opinion that Kibbola Kachpolta doesn't only apply with respect to determining what form of kosherization process you need, but even with respect to determining how hot the temperature has to be. So since all year long when you use it for chametz, it was only 550 maximum, so that's all you have to kosher it. Moshe Feinstein was very upset about this, and he used to tumble about that. He didn't insult Rabbi Soloveitchik in public, but he would always say publicly that he doesn't accept that, that the heating the oven until 550 degrees is not sufficient. Rav Soloveitchik Tetta, he said himself, Rav Soloveitchik Tetta was only for chametz b'tesach. For treifus, if you have an oven that was used for treifus and you want to use for kosher, you don't have this sek, you don't have these two tzedakos. They said that's a different question, that's already more serious. Rav Soloveitchik used to pride himself over the fact that he personally used to spend a lot of time, sometimes over an hour, sometimes over 2 hours, to peel off the sirchis on the lungs. He thought that he was a shtickel expert. And peeling off now, I think it's in America, probably nobody peels off any sirchis. They just sell it as non-kosher, pratik. It doesn't pay to spend 2 hours to remove a sirchis on the lungs. Just shecht another bainer, pratik. Sell this as non-kosher. But years ago, it was a big thing. So he used to peel off, so sometimes you would have the following. You have a big, you have an adhesion on the lung, and when you peel it off, you blow it up to see whether there's any air coming through. So sometimes at the center of the sirche, when you blow it, no air is coming through. Or if you submerge it under the water, bubbles don't come at that point. But at the mokum hispashtus ha-sirche, in the outskirts of the sirche, so there the bubbles will come up. So how could that be? How could that be? If there was a hole, shouldn't the hole have been at the center of the sirche? So shouldn't that indicate that you didn't peel it off? Well, really there was no hole over here, but at the time that you were peeling off, you didn't do a good job, and you ripped. And you ripped along after the shechita. So the Balatanya has a kula on this. And the Kutfi Sachlan, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, wrote his own Shulchan Aruch, and it has at the end, Soloveitchik's original chidushim. This is one of his haterim. That was Soloveitchik used to pride himself about the fact that he personally used to peel the sirches, and he used to rely on that kula of the Balatani. He was brought up in a Lubavitcher community as a child. Right, so he used to follow a lot of things from the Balatani. This is not the only thing. But in Kashrus, this is a big thing. At that time, now it's a joke. But at that time, this is a big thing to be makel on a bein. There was another issue about chometz that Rabbi Soloveitchik was in disagreement with Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has a published tshuva. If you have a Jewish shop where they have chometz dikit products, a Jewish store where they have a grocery store and they have chometz dikit products, and they arrange to have the chometz sold, they go to the rabbi, they ask the rabbi to sell the chometz. Fine, good. So there's no chometz, shovel of a pesach. But then the Jewish shopkeeper runs business as usual. He's selling all the products on Pesach, Wheaties and Cheerios, everything. Not that he puts it aside, and it's not his. Oh, so that's a religious shopkeeper will cover it up. This belongs to the guy. No, you have shopkeepers, Jewish shopkeepers. They just pashrayim the chametz with the rabbis and sell the chametz, and then they sell the chametz like regular. So what kind of business is that? So does that mean anything? The fact that they sold the chametz to the rabbis and the guy, it's a joke. No. So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein writes in his sefer, no, they sold the chametz and they're not in violation of Bayi Rabbi Moshe. If they sold the chametz, what are they running business? They got nothing. They're stealing from the goy. But whatever they did steal from the goy, whatever is left till after Pesach, that chametz didn't belong to them. That chametz belonged to the goy because they made a bona fide sale to the goy. So since they didn't violate Bayi Rabbi Moshe, so that chametz is mutter. That chametz is not chametz shalav apes. Rabbi Soloveitchik thought that that was an absolute joke. What do you mean? If he's running business as usual, so he demonstrates. Yeah, so he's demonstrating that the whole mechir is chametz, like a tchina. He doesn't take it seriously. So it's an umdin of the muchach that he never really meant to sell a chametz. Rabbi Soloveitchik wouldn't permit that, and he wouldn't permit the OU to give a hashgacha. They have big problems now. The OU follows this tzak from Rabbi Soloveitchik. They don't give a hashgacha. It's very uncomfortable when the OU sends out a questionnaire to a company that wants a hashgacha. So let's say it's a bakery. So they have to ask, do you have any Jewish partners? And if they have Jewish partners, then they have to be anti-Semitic and they can't give them hashgacha. Because if they have Jewish partners, it's chometz shalom about Pesach, unless they're prepared to close down for Pesach, or to sell the chometz and not to do any business on Pesach. But just to fashreiden the chometz, to sell the chometz, and continue to run the business on Pesach. So Rav Soloveitchik said, you're not allowed to give a hashgacha based on that. That's real chometz shalom about Pesach. He said, there's no heter on that at all.
I remember one time a Canadian buffer asked Yaakov Kamesky about the car was a my stop in a brewery. Mm-hmm. So he said, yes, because it's wide open ownership and you don't have any relation much to the product. And he said,
shares in a corporation.
Yeah,
the question, shares in a corporation, is that really considered, is that really considered that I'm a shutta from a part owner? Okay, so that's a shayla. Is it really considered that I am a part owner of the chometz? What do you say, no? That I have shares in the corporation, and the corporation owns legally,
right.
I have shares in the corporation, owns the chometz. So that's the question, whether the halacha recognizes this legal fiction, this legal distinction or not. Moshe Feinstein is mekel on that, many were mekel. I don't know what Rabbi Soloveitchik is thinking. Anyway, these are some of the highlights of the kashrus issues in Rabbi Soloveitchik's way of thinking. Again, I wouldn't describe Rabbi Soloveitchik not as a machmer, not as a mekel. He just analyzed every din and whatever came out, whatever he thought, and very often the same din, he would reanalyze it next year and come out differently. not due to any political pressures at all. He couldn't care less if that what was politically correct or incorrect. It was just that. Corn syrup was a big issue, right? That he changed. Yeah. On the corn syrup, 1 year before Pesach, when he gave this year for the Rabbanim, that a week before Pesach, so he announced that he's not allowed to eat any of the Barton's candy. For years, Barton had the hashgacha of Rabbi Cornell. So he said, you're not allowed to eat any Barton's candy because it has the Karo syrup. Has the Shemi kidney, you're not allowed to eat it. So the next day, in the middle of the year, they delivered, I think, a telegram that they're suing him. The company is suing him. All of our Barton went home and they announced that no one's allowed to eat their Barton's candy. So they can close up their business then. So the next year, Rabbi Soloveitchik thought it over and he said it was mutter, not because of that wouldn't affect him at all. He just became aware that many parts of Mekel on it, and its kidneys is only a mini, Hashem kidneys, many were Mekel, so I think the year or two after he said that it is a good Ashkar, that he made it. But that 1 year made a big stir, made a big talk.
What about Jello?
Jello, he used to say, oh, that kind of is cooler on the Jello. It depends, huh? Originally, when they originally made the Jello, they used to get it from ridiculous. You could get it from bones of non-kosher animals that had rotted already, that were lit from the achilat odom. It was inedible. I don't think they still make it like that. That was the original kula Rav Chaim Ozem. So he said, if that's the case, that would be mutter. No, Rabbi Soloveitchik's main strength in Shulchan Aruch, what we use from him all the time, is not so much anything that I mentioned today. This is all irrelevant. He explained all the dinim in Shulchan Aruch that we use every day. I didn't mention any of Chatecha Nasas Nevela and Tam Ki Iker. He gave so many shiurim on these things in the yeshiva every 2-3 years. He had to learn every day. He was unhappy about the system that he had in the yeshiva that all the boys learned Shulchan Aruch on their own. Because if he would give them the oral Bechina, they wouldn't understand anything. Of course they wouldn't understand. They wouldn't understand the way he understood. He would ask him a question that's slightly different from what it says. So everybody would be thrown off. They wouldn't understand. So he said, he doesn't like the whole system. He's got to change it. He insisted on giving shiurim. But every 2-3 years, they gave new students how to get tzmichas. So he used to learn every day, every 2-3 years. So I remember once in class, he was screaming at his students, why don't you understand it? He said, the rules know the every day already. So the students said, the rules are the every day already, 9 times. The first time I'm hearing the every day. He used to explain it very well. So that's what his shiurim on every day, we use all the time. But these are just some of the highlights of the pesukim that he gave. Maybe next month, something better. I'd like to talk about in Yonah of Shulchan Aruch Eben Ezra, about getting married, getting divorced, chalitza, different things about Shulchan Aruch Eben Ezra.
I'm scared.
What was it?
You know, I think from Hamburg.